I should admit the possibility. History will forgive me or excoriate me as is appropriate. I only wish it would forget me.
Jin listened to her father's explanations, his justifications, as they piled on one after another. Too many to consider, too many to argue against, years of Galen's personal analyses and self-recriminations spat out in the space of seconds. He was trying to answer her every question, anticipate every response, and the torrent denied her any opportunity for logic or fury. How could she not loathe him? How could her heart not break? She needed to sit. Her legs were swaying beneath her, as unstable as Saw's cane. She stood and watched.
So I did the one thing that nobody expected. I lied.
His voice grew steadier, as if here he stood on sure ground.
Or I learned to lie. I played the part of a beaten man, resigned to the sanctuary of his work. I made myself indispensable. And all the while, I laid the groundwork of my revenge. You may have heard rumors by now. Leaks regarding a battle station integrating an advanced laser prototype. The battle station is real. Its primary weapon has been built to penetrate the crust of a planetary object, to pour energy into a world until the bonds of matter fray and break. The ultimate result, we believe, would be the planet's violent obliteration. Nothing would survive. Nothing could ever be rebuilt. This battle station, we call it the Death Star. There is no better name.
Jin heard the horrors her father described, but it was only his spellbound tone that allowed her to notice it all. Her thoughts were fixed on his simple presence, his story of years of desperation and labor and doubt. My father is alive. My father is a traitor. My father is building a weapon to destroy worlds. Galen Erso is not my father. Galen Erso didn't raise me. She looked in vain to Saw, looked for the compassion she had derided and defied minutes before. Yet he too was watching the message, his expression cold and somber, as if for the first time he was hearing Galen's words and dwelling on their implications instead of searching for a trap.
My colleagues, many of them, have fooled themselves into thinking they are creating something so terrible and powerful it will never be used. But they're wrong. No weapon has ever been left on the shelf, and the day is coming soon when it will be unleashed.
His head turned from the recorder as if what he said next, more than anything, he feared to say aloud.
I've placed a flaw deep within the system. A scar so small and powerful, they'll never find it.
Jin knew the words mattered. Her father spoke with the breathless agony of a man baring his soul. It wasn't what she needed to hear. Not now. She no longer felt the swaying of her legs. Darkness crept around the edges of her vision, as if the hatch in her mind and the cave where the hatch had been were rising up to engulf her, as if she were descending, falling, to be locked away in her own skull with everything she'd denied. Galen shivered like a man dying in icy rain. The confession appeared to have been too much.
Jin, if you're listening.
He was slurring again, stumbling and urgent.
My beloved, so much of my life has been wasted. I try to think of you only in the moments when I'm strong, because the pain of not having you with me, your mother, our family.
He paused, seemed to try to refocus with limited effect.
The pain of that loss is so overwhelming, I risk failing even now. It's just so hard not to think of you. Think of where you are. I assume logically, rationally, that you fight with the rebellion. It's difficult to imagine Saw steering you any other way. And you always had the same anger.
He smiled for a second time. Here it was unforced, without self-mockery or bitterness.
The same insistent sense of righteousness as your mother. It frightens me to imagine you grown, somehow working to oppose injustice in the galaxy, whether from a laboratory or a starfighter. It frightens me, and I think the rebellion could ask for no better friend. Yet if it isn't so, if I'm wrong and you left the rebellion and soul behind, but this message still finds you, you make me no less proud, Jin. If you found a place in the galaxy untouched by war, a quiet life, maybe with a family. If you're happy, Jin, then that's more than enough.
Jin's jaw ached, clamped shut to hold in her screams. She couldn't swallow, could barely breathe. The cave walls rose around her until the only light in the blackness was the sapphire glow of the hologram.
If you're happy, Jin.
Galen snapped back into focus, no longer hesitant or soft.
Saw, the reactor system, that's the key. That's the place I've laid my trap. It's unstable, so one blast to any part of it will destroy the entire station.
She was losing her balance. Her legs shook and her head swam. Galen's words were fading behind a roar like the rush of blood in her ears. She tried to concentrate on his voice as if it were a lifeline to haul her out of oblivion.
You'll need the plans, the structural plans, to find your way. But they exist. Sabotage from the inside is impossible. Krennic is too paranoid. But I've thought about this, Saw. Prepared everything for you I could.
The roar was growing louder. The stones seemed to tremble and Jin fell to her knees. A shock of pain driving back the darkness of the cave long enough for her to realize that Saw too was shaking. His cane tapped rapidly on the floor.
I know there's at least one complete engineering archive in the data vault at the Citadel Tower on Scarif. Use what I've told you, run the analysis, and you'll be able to plan your attack. Any pressurized explosion to the reactor module will set off a chain reaction that will...
Without prelude, the hologram vanished. Not even the control lights on the console still gleamed. The voice was gone.
Saw Gerrera cried out something as the monastery lurched and a choking wave of dust billowed through the window.
Something terrible was happening on Jeddah. Jin knew that. But she'd lost her father. The cave beneath the ruined hatch swallowed her. Enveloped her in night. Chapter 7.
Krennic paced the overbridge under Tarkin's watch, observing the technicians and referencing every step against the control protocols he'd memorized long ago. Levers were flipped, rotating focusing lenses deep within the station's core. Engineers adjusted radiation baffles and ventilation pumps as the main reactor shook with effort and its comforting roar turned to an eerie scream. Krennic saw more than one hand shaking, more than one face flushed or daubed with sweat. But his officers knew their duty. They would do everything necessary to destroy Jeddah City at the bidding of their commander. Obedience and skill, of course, might not be enough. 8 separate beam generators came online in the Death Star's heart. Here the process became too much for Krennic to observe in its entirety. A dozen officers on the overbridge alone chattered into their comms, relaying information through a dozen more teams responsible for monitoring and controlling the primary weapon's final ignition. Krennic turned from the technicians to the monitor screens, saw readings gently crest as the 8 beams reached minimum coherency. From the focusing dish on the station's outer shell, the beams of light and charged particles poured into a single vertex, controlled and suspended by the Kyber fields. The overbridge's main display blazed with green fire set against the void of space. And Krennic stepped forward,
staring in awe at the conflagration. The radiance of the display splashed over his white uniform, over the black helmets of the technicians, over Tarkin's grave face, and rendered the room in carved emerald. For a moment, the blazing nexus of energy hung in the void. Krennic tensed involuntarily. This was the moment where so many tests and computer simulations had failed him. He had seen the nexus sputter and die, or expand to consume the station itself. He had seen calculations collapse under their own weight, as predictions gave way to haphazard guesswork. He had seen successes too, but they gave him no confidence now. Then, the last stage was triggered. From the center of the focusing dish came another particle beam, invisible to the human eye. It carved through the nexus and tunneled a path for the energy's release, funneled the conflagration away from the battle station, and toward the rust-brown sphere of the Jeddah moon. The atmosphere seemed to flare where the beam struck. Krennic tried to imagine the incineration of the holy city and the ensuing shockwave. He found his mind failed him. Surely no one could imagine such a thing. He had killed a city. He could kill a world. Every morning, Megone ate her breakfast before the smoke ceremony. According to certain ancient customs, this was an act of heresy. But she'd done it every day for 60-odd years, and no cosmic power had ever smacked the eggs from her withered hands or turned the water in her canteen to blood. Besides, it seemed to Megone that a dollop of heresy kept a person from getting too wrapped up in the particulars of tradition. Smoke ceremonies and pilgrimages don't put one in touch with the Force, she once told a disappointed visitor to her shrine. Best they can do is focus head and heart. It was while making breakfast over her portable stove, just outside her tiny shrine in the mountains beyond the city, that Megone noticed the dark silhouette in the sky. It was no more than a smear to her roomy eyes, and she tried to rub it from her vision with her knuckles. It remained, despite her efforts, a blemish on the dim gray heavens. She trembled as she adjusted the stove's heat. Her body had been failing her more and more lately. The dull pain in her ankles had worsened the past few weeks, and the mole she could feel on the nape of her neck had gotten larger. "Admit it, Megone," she mumbled. "You're finally getting old." She looked back to the smudge in the sky. It wore a fiery halo now, and the world seemed darker, as if the smudge had eclipsed the sun itself. Mixed with her confusion was the elated thought, "Maybe it's not my sight after all." Then the smudge flashed a brilliant emerald, and her vision spotted as if she'd been staring into a fire. Megone felt the heat wash over her body, but she felt no pain. She ignited in an incandescent burst of burning air, turned to ash and less than ash in an instant. At the age of 93... she was not ready to die. Pendra was pouting. Larn was praying the pout didn't sour and become a full-blown tantrum. He loved his daughter, but he'd seen her shriek for an hour straight, and he was late for work already. "You're going to stay with Aunt Jola today," he said. "She has those toys you like, remember? The ones that belonged to Cousin Cat?" Larn knew very well that his daughter had ignored the toy starship models the last time they'd gathered at Jola's. Still, if he lied in a soothing enough voice, there was always the chance Pendra would believe him. Instead, his daughter ignored his words as he adjusted her boots.
"I want to go with Mom,"
she whimpered. "So do I," Larn thought. then cursed aloud as he tried to stand and banged his shoulders against the kitchen table. Kendra was continuing her protests, but he wasn't listening anymore. He scooped her up in both arms, glancing about the cramped apartment to make sure he hadn't forgotten anything. So far as he could tell, Kendra didn't remember the fight in the Holy Quarter. She didn't remember nearly dying and being saved by the whim of... who had it been? Not a rebel and not an imperial, but, according to Huica, some woman caught in the crossfire. When had Jedha become such a death trap? It hadn't always been this way. And now they were going to work, doing their shopping like nothing had happened. Maybe Larn thought he could talk to Huica. Maybe she was right about finding a way off-world. But not tonight. Tonight, he just wanted her home safe. Larn and Pendra Seelu didn't see the emerald light or hear the thunder before they died. Pendra never left her father's arms. The order to evacuate had come while JN-093 was in the Outlands doing recon on suspected rebel hiding spots. All she and her squad had turned up was a shallow cave packed with empty supply crates. Now she was waiting for pickup. So far from the city, they'd never make it back on foot in time for liftoff.
You know why we're being moved off-world?
JN-092 asked. He was pacing awkwardly by the edge of a long, dry lake bed, occasionally digging the toe of his boot into the dust.
I don't,
JN-093 said, though she doubted she would have told to if she did know. He was a stormtrooper. He should have known better than to ask. JK-027 lapped into the calm in his resonant bass. He was nearly out of sight, scanning the horizon from atop a boulder.
You're getting cozy here? Afraid to leave?
Two grumbled something insulting that didn't quite cut through the static. JN-093 shook her head in irritation. There was something going on between K and Two. She wasn't sure what, but it had started after they'd come back from a night at the cantina. She made a note to question them if they didn't reconcile soon. She didn't need her squad members at one another's throats. Where was the blasted pickup anyway? Kay was looking at the sky now. JN-093 felt a shadow fall across the valley, allowed her helmet visor to automatically compensate. She scowled as she tried to contact transport control. The comms seemed to be working, but no one was answering. Two prized off his helmet and tossed it to the ground. He too craned his neck to look skyward. JN-093 prepared to scold him when a surprised voice finally came through.
JN-093, please confirm. Your squad's still on the ground?
You forgot us? She wanted to ask.
Affirmative,
she said.
Still waiting for pickup.
Sorry, 093. You may be stuck out there a while. Just gotta...
A pause.
I'm really sorry.
The voice cut out. The comm hissed. JN-093 kicked at the dirt. K and Two were standing by the lake bed together now, both with their helmets off, still staring at the sky. She started to stroll toward them. Maybe they're making up, she thought. And Two started laughing when the sky turned emerald. JN-093 was thrown into the dirt as the ground bucked and a gale whipped across the valley. In the direction of Jedha City, the horizon glowed as if a new sun were rising. A sun of white and green fire that swelled and burst, spilling forth destruction. JN-093 instinctively screamed orders into her comm, though no one was listening. She pushed herself to crawl toward her team as the gale grew stronger and black clouds rose and shrouded the distant fire. She fought against the battering wind and dust for what felt like minutes. The next time she could think and see, she was behind a ridge of boulders dragging Two by one arm. He was coughing and brushing sand from his face. A wall of churning ruin filled the horizon, rapidly marching closer. Kay was nowhere in sight. JN-093 finally thought to look at the shadow in the sky. She stared at the structure, indefinably large and eclipsing the sun. She knew a weapon when she saw one, no matter how incomprehensible.
They did it,
she murmured.
The rebels finally did it.
Two sputtered weak laughter. I don't think that's the rebels, he said. When the storm front hit them, JN-093's armor protected her just long enough to make her death painful. In her last flicker of brain activity, she felt she'd failed her squad. Saw Gerrera looked from the window of the Kadera Monastery and saw his death on the horizon. The holy city was gone. In its place was a roiling storm of sand and fire, like the work of some primal deity. The bed of the valley flowed like an ocean, save where fissures opened and drew the land into itself. The wind battered him, burning with heat and stinking of ozone. He inhaled one scorching lungful of dust, then clamped his oxygen mask to his face. He found himself transfixed by the monstrosity before him. Saw had seen many terrible weapons over the years. Disruptor beams that tore soldiers apart. Screamers that left the residents of whole city blocks hallucinating and bleeding from their ears. Viruses that spread on the wind and adapted to every species imaginable. He had used those same weapons and numbed himself to the outrage of the Rebel Alliance. Yet now, he saw something beyond all his dark dreams, and he remembered fear.
No, don't lie to yourself. You feared your death for a long time, and more with every day.
He turned away from the window, stumbled, and saw his console spark with one last surge of power. He thought of his soldiers in the catacombs, considered what order to give. But they were surely evacuating already. His lieutenants knew the next rendezvous, and they knew their duty. Well enough to also know he would only slow them down. He envisioned dragging his failing body, trapped in its unwieldy armor, down the collapsing corridors of the monastery with the support of a warrior under each arm. It was a humiliation. It was a fantasy. It's time, Saul. Past time. There was only Jin then. The girl was on her hands and knees, still staring at the dead hollow projector. Saul felt a jolt of ire and shame. Had she become soft after all these years? Which he routed from his mind. Whatever had become of Jin, she was still his. Still his best soldier. Still his only family. The floor jumped, and the tip of his cane skidded out from beneath him. Saw crashed to the ground as chips of stone pelted him from the ceiling. His armor cushioned him from the worst of the blow. The pain was, as always, in the act of motion, in lifting himself back to his feet and clambering to Jin's side. He tried to speak, cursed his enervated lungs and the coughing fit that followed. He sucked at his oxygen mask, and watched Jin reflexively rise off her hands without turning from the projector. She was better than this. Better than behaving like an Imperial pilot ravaged by Boar Gullet. He found his comlink, rasped a demand for aid, and heard no response but static. He could count on no one else to rescue Jin. Saw had to make her remember. Remember that she was his best soldier. Remember that she had a mission to complete, a war to fight, a Death Star to destroy, an emperor to execute for all the crimes of a nation. He grasped her shoulder as tight as he could and spat her name. Jin! He cried. My daughter! But Jin didn't seem to hear.
Chapter 8.
What was the message?
Cassian asked.
You can tell me the message.
Baze grunted behind him. The pilot refused to look directly at Cassian. They'd gone around twice already. Cassian asking questions and the broken man answering in jumbled words and mumbles. There were hints of insight to be found. Cassian had heard the words planet killer more than once, but little else. He wanted to tear the answers bodily from the man he'd come so far to find.
This had to be worth it. The message, the mission, it had to be worth the cost. Brought the message, the pilot finally said. Brought it from Galen. Brought it from Edu. Edu.
He dimly recalled the name from some Alliance intelligence file, a planet somewhere in the Outer Rim. It was a thread Cassian could follow. Then the catacombs began to rumble. Outside the cell, skulls skittered out of their niches on the walls and shattered on the stone floor. The lights flickered, and guards rushed to exit the outer chamber. An absurd obsessive instinct in Cassian urged him to ignore the quake, to keep the pilot talking, but he tamped down the compulsion enough to recognize the opportunity he'd been provided.
"Proton bombs!"
Bay said, turning his eyes to the ceiling. Chirrut shook his head.
"No."
But he ventured no alternatives. Cassian freed his security kit from his boot and began work on the cell's lock, clipping wires and shifting tumblers. The quake's force steadily increased, causing his hands to jerk and slip. Finally, the lock made a satisfying click, and the door slid open. He had barely enough time to pull his arms out from the bars. He dashed for the table where the group's gear had been stashed as Baze tugged Chirrut along after.
"Let's go!"
Baze snapped. Cassian snatched up his blaster in one hand, fumbled for his comlink with the other, and signaled,
"K2! K2, where are you?"
"Please be at the ship. Please don't say you followed me. We're so close here."
The comlink crackled with static, and an almost incomprehensible voice replied.
"There you are. I'm standing by as you ordered, though there is a problem on the horizon."
"What problem?"
Cassian spat.
"There is no horizon. On a positive note, I may have found our planet killer."
The catacombs shuddered and bucked, nearly tossing Cassian to his knees. It wasn't until he regained his balance that he understood what the droid was talking about. What was happening on the surface? And did it matter? The planet killer was real. It's here. He felt a thrill, realizing what they'd found. Realizing he would return to the rebellion not just successful, but wildly so, with an eyewitness account of the monster they faced. Realizing that he was imperiled by a menace unheard of in galactic history, and that he would survive or not according to his own skill. The thrill was arrested by the chill that worked its way down his back and the sweat on his brow.
"Locate our position," he said. "Bring that ship in here now!"
5 minutes to extraction, if I make it at all.
Cassian glanced sidelong at Baze, who was either inspecting or caressing his blaster cannon.
5 minutes. It wasn't nearly fast enough, and far too fast for what he wanted. Jin was still missing, in the hands of Saw or whatever torturers Saw had sicked on Bodhi Rook.
She was extraneous now. Cassian no longer needed Saw, and Bodhi could lead the rebels to Galen Erso on his own. Worse than extraneous, he told himself. She'll try to stop what comes next. All Cassian had to do was forget the need in her eyes. Leave her behind as he'd left behind Tivik on the Ring of Kafreen. As he'd left behind men on Ilora Saint and Chemvau.
"Where are you going?"
Chirrut shouted. Cassian was already halfway to the cavern exit.
"I've got to find Jin," he called. "You get the pilot. We need him. Then if you want to ride out of here, meet me up top."
It was as much a threat as an offer. There was barely enough light to navigate the catacombs. Cassian followed the flashes of swinging overheads, and as he caught up, the handhelds carried by Saw's fleeing soldiers. The rebels all traveled the same path, and Cassian raced upstairs and around corners in their wake. No one seemed to notice a lone prisoner in pursuit. He scaled the steps to the main floor of the monastery and heard new noises over the rumbling of the mountain and the shouts of evacuating rebels. The engines of starships, and beyond, a terrible howling wind like the hurricanes of Squar. The soldiers scattered from a central chamber, gears slung over their shoulders or abandoned on the ground. Cassian wondered if any of them would survive to see the stars. As a Twi'lek rebel bolted past, Cassian caught the man by his cyan headtails and tossed him against a wall.
"Where's Jean Erso?"
he asked. "Where was she taken?" The Twi'lek pushed back instinctively. He was young and slim, slim enough that Cassian had underestimated him. But he was still a fighter, still one of Saw's. He slammed a fist into Cassian's ribs. Cassian caught the next blow and forced his opponent to the wall again.
"I'm not here to fight. What's your name?"
he growled. The boy stared, uncomprehending.
"What's your name?"
"Ray Sodan,"
the boy said.
"Ray Sodan. Making him angry won't help you. Keep him calm. We can beat each other up while this place falls apart, or you can tell me where you took Jean Erso. The prisoner from before. The one separate from the rest."
The boy took barely a moment to decide.
"Saw's chambers. The upper level. But I haven't seen him since..."
Cassian turned and sprinted away. Saw had left the pilot behind. Maybe if Cassian was lucky, he was cruel enough to leave Jin too. He ascended another stairway, two steps at a time. The monastery made a noise like thunder as some part of the structure collapsed altogether. Cassian was forced to put his sleeve over his mouth and nostrils to keep himself from choking on the dust. Power cables led him to a doorway filled by a tattered curtain where he tripped on something soft. The heap of a rebel body, a youth with a rifle longer than her arm. No blaster marks, Cassian thought. Poor kid must have come for Saw and cracked her head during one of the tremors. She might have been alive, but she wasn't his concern. He called Jin's name, pushed forward through the curtains, and found what he was looking for. Jin was squatting on the floor of the chamber within, her shoulders slumped and her arms limp. With each shudder of the monastery, she shifted her weight, straightened to avoid toppling over, but those were the only motions she made. She was staring sightlessly across the room. She didn't seem to notice the armored figure crouched before her. Saw Gerrera. Older, much older than the images Cassian had seen in the dossier at Base One, but unmistakably Saw. What had he done? Saw lifted his head. Bloodshot eyes met Cassian's own. The man squinted in thought, then rasped, as if reading the rage and the question on Cassian's face.
"This was not my doing. She wasn't ready for what she saw."
Cassian wanted to yell, "What does that mean?" But Saw spoke again in a voice that defied interruption.
"If you can save her," he said bitterly, "take her."
The monastery was falling apart. If K2 was coming, he'd arrive momentarily. There was no time. Saw's answer would have to be good enough. Cassian knelt by Jin. Her eyes were glassy, unfocused.
"We've got to go,"
he said, soft and stern. She flinched at the sound. Nothing more. Cassian swore to himself.
"Leave her behind."
It would be easier than he'd expected. The need had burned out of her eyes. The feral instinct to survive had been buried kilometers deep. He'd be leaving behind an empty shell.
"I know where your father is," he said.
Jin blinked. Her eyes flickered toward Cassian.
"Go, Jin!"
Saw's voice, commanding even in its frailty.
"You must go!"
Jin rose to her feet on trembling legs. Her breath hissed between barely parted lips. She turned a blank face to look over the room, over Cassian and Saw. and reached out to grasp her mentor's arm. Something passed between Jin and Saw that Cassian couldn't begin to read. Saw spoke simply, softly.
Save yourself, please.
Jin's face seemed to flash with anger, but her fingers unclenched from Saw, and Cassian grabbed her other arm, tugging her toward the doorway.
Come on,
he said, and she stumbled one step, then two.
Go!
Saw urged, somehow stronger now, his voice competing against the tumbling rocks that clattered beyond the chamber window. Jin took another step, but her gaze remained on the old rebel.
There's no time!
Cassian snapped. He pulled at her again, and now she was moving, unsteady yet swift, making for the corridor at Cassian's side. Saw's bellows seemed to shatter stone behind them and dwarf even the roar of the cataclysm.
Save the rebellion!
He cried.
Save the dream!
Bodhi Rook understood the distinction between past and present, between recollection and reality. He just wasn't sure which was which anymore. Bor Gullet had taken everything Bodhi was, every intimate thought and dream, every cherished or forsaken memory, and torn through it with tendrils like scalpels. A scrap of first kiss drifted, ripped and sodden into a pile on the right. A ribbon of kyber crystals floated to the pile on the left, pressed and preserved for further examination. When Bor Gullet and Saw had completed their investigation, Bodhi had tried to stuff every memory back into his mind. He was certain they hadn't all fit quite right.
I'm the pilot!
Who had he said that to? Someone had listened to him at last! Or was that a memory from long ago? Was he still in the cage with Bor Gullet? No, but he was in another cage. It smelled of his own putrid scent. His flight suit chafed his icy flesh, irritated his sores, and ground dirt into his wounds. The whole world was rumbling like a ship taking flight. Surely that, Bodhi thought, was a memory.
The pilot, a voice said, low and full of scorn.
He focused on the source and saw through the bars of his cage a hulk of a man with dark, wild hair. Behind him stood a slimmer man who carried a staff. The first man, the name Baze, surfaced in Bodhi's brain, though Bodhi couldn't have guessed where he'd heard it, raised a blaster cannon and pointed it at Bodhi's chest.
Panic helped Bodhi find words. Wait! He cried. No!
He stumbled to his feet, readied himself for the pain of death. He heard the blaster shot and felt nothing. The door to his cell slid open. Baze was scowling at him, pointing his weapon at the burnt and sparking control panel.
Come on!
The second man called. His name is Chirrut.
Let's go!
Was this reality? Was this a rescue? Bodhi nearly twisted an ankle on his first step. The ground bucked on his second. Then he was running, chasing after Baze and Chirrut and praying that he had found his salvation at last, found the welcome Galen Erso had promised him when he had said to seek out the rebellion to make amends. Maybe, Bodhi thought, just maybe his torment was over. He recognized some of the faces running with him. There were whole crowds beyond Baze and Chirrut, clattering through the stone hallways with rifles and duffels slung over their shoulders. Among them were Bodhi's captors, the men and women who'd bound him, blinded him, marched him at gunpoint across the desert when he'd begged simply to help them. They didn't look at him now, didn't seem to see him. He pushed his aching legs and cold lungs harder to keep pace.
They'll kill us,
he whispered to Baze.
You don't know these people.
Baze laughed so loud that Bodhi was terrified the rebels would look back. They kept running.
Forgive my friend,
Chirrut said.
You would think it's funny, too, if you knew he wanted you dead most of all.
Bodhi didn't find that funny in the slightest. But a rescue was a rescue.
They ran out of the catacombs, up ancient steps worn smooth over centuries, and burst into the frigid dawn. Sunlight slashed Bodhi's eyes with cuts of blue and green and silver. He couldn't recall when he'd last seen sunlight, though Bor Gullet would have known. He staggered to a stop behind Baze and Chirrut, standing on a broad mountain ledge overlooking a valley. The rebels were gone, scattered, somewhere. In the valley there was nothing but dust, a billowing, blooming storm of sand expanding outward in all directions and rolling across the valley floor. Baze's lips parted without words. He watched like a man in shock.
"What do you see?"
Chirrut asked Baze. Bodhi blinked away the scars of light. When his eyes had adjusted, he realized that the valley was now too dim. He raised his stiff neck, looked to the sky, and saw a shadow like a moon eclipsing the sun.
"What do you see?"
Chirrut asked again. Realizations crashed together. Bodhi was on Jeddah, had never left Jeddah, and he was looking onto the valley where the holy city had been. And above him, in the sky...
"No,"
he whispered.
"No!"
This was not a rescue. This was a trick of Bor Gullet. This was the reason he had left the Empire, abandoned his friends, trusted the words of Galen Erso, suffered torment and humiliation to stop the battle station, stop the planet killer from coming to life. What he saw was not real. It could not be.
It wasn't supposed to happen yet.
He whispered, though no one listened. He was too late. This was his fault. Scalding wind cut through the cold, nearly blasted him from his feet. The dust storm was getting closer. Then he heard another noise, a screaming boom, separate from the thunderous rumble of the storm. Descending toward the mountain was a ship, a UT-60D U-Wing transport. It dipped awkwardly in the buffeting wind, trying to match the level of the ledge. Baze wrapped an arm around Chirrut, started toward the ship.
"Okay, let's go!"
What was the point, Bodhi wondered. They'd already lost. An open palm smacked Bodhi between the shoulders.
"Move!"
a man called. He rushed past, pulling a woman by the hand. Bodhi had seen the man before, he thought. He remembered a gentle, almost pitying voice.
What was the point? He didn't want to die.
He followed the man, followed Baze and Chirrut through the air that was growing ever thicker with dust. Sand beat his flesh and raked his hair. He couldn't hear the Ewing's boarding ramp descend, but he saw the aperture, a window in the storm. The others were ahead of him, sprinting inside, making the final jump with apparent ease. Bodhi leapt, but his quaking legs failed him. He was falling onto the ramp when a hand caught him, yanked him violently forward an instant before the cabin door shut. He didn't see who it was who'd saved his life.
"Get us out of here!"
a voice yelled.
"Punch it!"
The cabin lurched and swayed. Baze, Chirrut, and the woman clutched at the seats and support struts to keep from being dashed against the walls. But even with the floor unsteady beneath him, even with the metallic wail of the wind against the bulkhead, Bodhi felt comforted. He was on a ship now. He knew ships. The hull shrieked as something heavy bounced off the top of the U-Wing. The deck dropped, sent Bodhi onto his hands and knees, and drove spikes of pain into his wrists. He went sliding as the ship banked. He recognized the sound of the engine. An Incom Corporation rebuild of their 9XR standby, as it strained against the storm. Bodhi dragged himself forward and clambered into the cockpit. He'd never seen a U-Wing cockpit before. Seated at the controls were a droid and the man who'd passed by him before. Cassian,
Was that his name? They were adjusting thrust madly, trying to ride the waves of the dust storm, trying to turn the ship away from the epicenter and maneuver through the mountains as they cracked and shattered. Bodhi didn't interrupt. He watched their hands play over the controls. He read the instruments and the scanners, nearly useless, never meant for these conditions. He felt the U-wing rise on a crest of the storm, shuddering all the way as it tried to match speed, and saw a shadow creep over the cockpit as a heavier, hotter cloud raced overhead and began to fall. He was going to die after all. His rescue was over, and it was his own fault. If he'd been faster, the rebels might have stopped the planet killer. "I'm sorry," he whispered. Cassian and the droid didn't hear him. He understood that Borg Gullet was gone from his mind. Yet the memory that seized him was every bit as vivid as those the creature had evinced. Bodhi looked out the viewport and saw, instead of the dust storm, the emerald and turquoise hues of titanic gas clouds. Lightning volleys like alien dancers leapt from one cloud to the next, causing each to ignite and burst. Bodhi was laughing as his shuttle, a new class transport barely viable for training runs, bounced and twirled, and his classmates cheered him on. It was a memory of utter serenity. Then his flight through the gas giant of Bamiyar 9 was over, and he was gazing into the dust storm again, as darkness closed around the U-wing. "Look!" he cried, and reached toward the viewport, toward a speck of light, a gateway through the dust, collapsing as the wave above them crashed down. Cassian didn't turn toward Bodhi. Maybe he hadn't heard. But the rebel snarled, "Come on!" as he diverted power again, urged the ship through that speck of light as oblivion raged around them. And the sky turned blue, then black, and the viewport filled with stars. The U-wing leapt into hyperspace, and Bodhi laughed on the floor of the cockpit in giddy joy. Chapter 9. The Death Star's overbridge was dark, except for the lit rows of instrumentation and the glow of the main display. Dominating that vast screen was what remained of the valley of the holy city of Jeddah, a churning, whirling, burning storm of sand and rock shards. The air, ionized by the energy of the Death Star's weapon, flashed with lightning. At the storm's epicenter, the crater of the incinerated city smoldered where the beam had sublimed the outermost layer of the moon's crust. This was not the fate Krennic had envisioned for Jeddah. The Death Star was designed to obliterate worlds, not maim them. Yet he wondered if the moon would ever recover from such an attack, or whether the cascading effects of a burning atmosphere and broken crust would result in a torturous death played out across millennia. He felt in his bones that his weapon had exposed something profound about the nature of worlds, about their lifeblood and their death throes, though he could not have put it into words. Maybe, he thought, that's what poets are for. "It's beautiful," he murmured, breaking minutes of near silence on the bridge. Even Tarkin had respected the crew members' shared awe as they spoke in whispers and muffled their keystrokes.
"I believe I owe you an apology, Director Krennic," Tarkin replied. "Your work exceeds all expectations."
Krennic did his best to conceal his surprise.
"And you'll tell the Emperor as much?"
"Too eager." He moderated his tone. He could afford humility if it would comfort Tarkin.
After all, this is his triumph. The triumph of his insight and will, more than any other single man's.
"There. Enough for you to save face, but not enough to deny me credit." Tarkin cut the air with a dismissive gesture.
"The Emperor desires facts, not flattery. Your tenure on this project has been rife with setbacks. Setbacks you have, it seems, overcome. I will tell him his patience with your misadventures has been rewarded with a weapon that will bring a swift end to the rebellion. You're too kind, Governor. Condescending bastard. But you express my hopes as well. We've seen that the Death Star might destroy a city or rebel base unimpeded by planetary shields or defense grids. And what you witnessed today, that is only an inkling of the destructive potential. The same gesture as before. A demand for silence. Smiling acidly, contritely, Krennic obliged. I will tell him, Tarkin said, that I will be taking control over the weapon I first spoke of years ago. Effective immediately. Taking control? Krennic curled gloved fingers into fists and looked about the overbridge as he quelled his first and most vicious response. The duty officers were not watching the confrontation. They remained busy at their stations, checking and rechecking the Death Star's primary weapon status and scanning the system for survivors. That was a very small comfort. Krennic stepped as close as he dared to Will of Tarkin and snapped. We are standing here amid my achievement, not yours! He forced his voice into a hiss. My people are loyal, and my people are the only ones capable of operating this station. He knew it was unwise to threaten Tarkin openly. He could berate a subordinate without repercussions, but not the Grand Moff. And there was no imminent scenario in which Krennic could remove or replace Tarkin. He would need to suffer the man's existence for some time to come. But Krennic was not a man to smile meekly forever. Tarkin shrugged as if he hadn't heard the threat, as if he was certain that the officer's loyalty was far too malleable to be a problem. He might have been right. I'm afraid these recent security breaches have laid bare your inadequacies as a military director. Your place, I think, is among the engineers. There are many initiatives that could benefit from your organizational skills. The security breaches have been filled, Krennic retorted. Jeddah has been silenced. There was a flaw in that argument, too, Krennic knew. The ignition of the weapon and the ensuing storm had left the Death Star's sensors momentarily blind. It was conceivable that survivors had escaped the moon. Conceivable, but unlikely. Tarkin had a different countermove in mind. You think this pilot acted alone? He let out a wheezing half-laugh. He was dispatched from the installation on Edu. Galen Erso's facility. Galen Erso. Galen Erso. Fury made a fool of Krennic. This time, he could not hide his surprise. We'll see about this, he snarled, and turned to leave the overbridge. General David Draven was the bane of his peers and a hero to his subordinates. It wasn't the role he wanted to play, but he believed it was a necessary one. As an organization, the Rebel Alliance was held together more by external pressure than by internal bonds. Mon Mothma's almost pathological need to make political overtures toward peace, regardless of their success, was a poor match for General Jan Dodonna's policy of covert strikes that minimized attention from the Empire and its Senate. Dodonna's approach, in turn, was incompatible with Bail Organa's desire to rapidly intervene wherever Imperial atrocities occurred. Saw Gerrera had effectively withdrawn from the Alliance over strategic disagreements. But there were other Council members who shared his more aggressive agenda. If not for the Empire's overwhelming strength, if not for the need for the Rebels to work together to even survive, the Alliance would have fractured in a matter of months. If not for the Empire's strength, and if not for General Draven...
While his peers argued and mapped out roads to an imaginary ultimate victory, Draven maintained a singular focus on protecting the Alliance itself, on ruthlessly defending the organization and its people while correcting their mistakes. If that earned him a reputation for arrogance or intrusiveness, it was a small price to pay. In the matter of the supposed planet killer, Draven feared there was nothing but mistakes to correct. A few of those mistakes were even his own, yet he had no intention of shirking his duties. He marched into the comm center on Yavin 4 with his head held high and his shoulders stiff, the way soldiers imagined a general. He hoped the rebels on duty would forgive the sweat on his brow from the jungle heat.
"What do you have?"
he demanded. Private Weems leapt to his feet.
"A coded message from Captain Andor, sir," he said.
That was fast. Andor was smart, thorough, and not particularly inclined to make contact during the course of a mission. This time around, he also had the Urso girl to contend with. Draven hadn't expected to hear from him for a week at best. "What's he got for us?" Draven asked. Weems read in the deliberate tone of a man pretending not to see what he was seeing.
"Weapon confirmed. Jedha City destroyed. Mission target located on Edu. Please advise."
"Destroyed?" Draven echoed. Weems only nodded. The planet killer is real. Doubt followed instantly in the wake of that thought. Andor was a fine agent, but not flawless. His message was vague. The transmission could have been intercepted and altered en route. There were 1,000 reasons why weapon confirmed might not be confirmation at all. But Draven had seen too many commanders use doubt as an excuse to deny the obvious. He hadn't really believed in the planet killer before, not rationally, not in the cold strategic part of his mind that was, he could admit, if to no one but himself, his only true value to the Rebel Alliance. If the weapon was active, then the strategic framework of the entire galaxy was in flux. Everything the Rebellion had built, every scheme from every council member, would have to adapt. But urgent decisions had to be made first. Andor's message contained nothing new on Galen Erso. Those assumptions remained intact, and if Erso was instrumental in the Planet Killer project, then maybe Draven could give the Alliance breathing room. A chance to evolve before worlds, instead of cities, started dying.
"Proceed," he told Weems.
"Tell him my orders still stand. Tell him to proceed with haste and keep to the plan. We have to kill Galen Erso while we have the chance."
The first time Jean had been orphaned was on a farm on a shoreline of the planet Lamu. She had seen her mother shot by a death squad and watched her father surrender to the man responsible, abandon her to a soldier he barely knew. The second time had been in the deserts of Jedha, when she had seen the man who raised her, the man who had taught her everything, whom she hated more than almost anyone, buried beneath a mountain after being nothing but kind, or as kind as he knew how to be. Perhaps she'd never been orphaned at all, however. Galen Erso was alive. Not the gentle farmer she remembered, nor the coward and monster who'd left her behind to become an Imperial weaponeer, earning years of spite. Both of those men had died on Jedha as well. There was another Galen Erso. All she knew of him was a sapphire light in the cave in her mind, the cave where she lived now, repeating the same words over and over. Words about love and happiness and loneliness. Excuses for deeds done long ago. Plans and lies about a Death Star, a planet killer. "My love for her has never faded." She couldn't stop the words. Each one tore at her, and she clung to them for solace.
She sat in the cabin of the U-Wing and stared out at her companions from the cave's depths. She watched their faces through the distant